This is Pod Save the UK.
I'm Coco Khan.
And I'm Nish Kumar.
Is there any cause you believe in so strongly that you'd be willing to sacrifice your freedom for it?
If you're watching this video, I'm in prison. And I'm in prison because of action that I have consciously taken as part of a campaign of civil resistance against this government.
That's Chloe Naldred, theatre producer, mother of two, Just Stop Oil activist, and our guest on this week's show.
With Rishi Sunak hitting out against eco-zealots whilst leaving the climate crisis off his list of five priorities,
it's time to ask, whose side are we on? And is it time to just stop oil? Welcome to Pod Save the UK. Hi, Coco.
Hi, Nish.
How's your week been?
Do you know what? It's been surprisingly good, thanks to a unlikely wellness intervention from Space Karen, a.k.a. Elon Musk.
What?
Did you not have that thing where you had your Twitter limited?
I don't know. My relationship with Twitter has drifted somewhat.
Right, okay.
So it has drifted somewhat. I think there was a point at which I just started to think, why would I voluntarily open, like if the post, if every day in the post I got 50 letters telling me that I should kill myself, I would stop getting the post.
Yeah, I can see what you mean.
So I think I had to change my relationship, especially when Elon took over and, you know, took over Twitter on a platform of, we should have more Nazis on this. That was the point where I was like, maybe I'll slightly take a step back from this website. So I definitely use it way less. So I actually didn't, it didn't practically impact my use of
okay,
it.
Okay.
Well, so did you actually have it?
Yeah. So I had the thing that, you know, you log on to Twitter.
So what happens when you exceed your limit?
You just can't see what anyone else is tweeting.
Really?
It's like you're not able to view anyone else because you're not important enough. He already took my blue tick, can I just say?
Yeah, he already took
my bloody tick. And then he said I couldn't use it. And so he basically did what my therapist has been saying for many years, which is get the fuck off Twitter. So to answer your question, I had no Twitter all weekend. So I just like wrote things. I read things. I was reading about trying to catch up with this horrendous situation in France. Did you know the sort of average age of the rioters in France are 17?
Yeah.
I mean, to be that young and that disillusioned, there's clearly a problem,
yeah,
a massive problem in France.
Completely.
So I was reading about that, and this is kind of related, but also maybe not. But this story came up as a part of the many stories that are around this France situation. They did Haute Couture Week whilst Paris was burning. They still sent people down the runway, which is like, you know, very, very fashion thing to do. And
it's dreadfully Marie Antoinette. Like, I hate to bring that lady up in conjunction with French history, but you have to say there's something of the Antoinette about that endeavour.
I mean, it is a touch on the tone deaf side, isn't it? But I don't know if you know this about me, that I love fakes.
What do you mean?
Like fake designer items. Yeah, I love them.
Yeah, right, okay.
When I was a kid, obviously, it was because I was skin and like we couldn't afford Adidas, so you wore Abby Bass, yeah, obviously. Yeah. But now that
Abby Hash is what I remember.
Reebok was my favourite.
Ah, Nokia.
Yeah. But now I'm older, I genuinely love them as like an absurd piece of work. And also I'm happy that I'm upsetting the powers of the design houses. You know, I'm walking around in Christian Dior,
yeah,
and probably there's someone in France really like feeling very hard done by for that. And the reason, again, I wanted to bring this up to you is because before we did this podcast, I was like, I'm going to tell Nish about my love of fakes. And I Googled like fakes to see what was out there.
Yeah.
And I just need to warn you that there is a present coming for you. And the present is, are you aware that Adidas have a new slogan, which is impossible is nothing?
I am aware of that,
right,
yeah.
Okay.
Because it's like one of those absolutely hilarious like corporate slogans that genuinely means nothing. You're like, yeah, impossible is nothing. You're like, it is a thing. Like, it's literally a thing. It's impossible for man to fly. And if you want to test that theory, jump off a cliff without a parachute, Adidas.
Well, you're going to love this version that I have because it's a bag, but it's been garbled, maybe accidentally, or maybe as a piece of ironic art. I don't know. But the slogan is, nothing is possible. So I can't wait to get it for you. There was another one.
I really love nihilist fake Adidas.
Yeah. Actually,
the Nike version would just be, don't bother.
Don't do it. Actually, if any of our listeners come across any great fakes,
yeah,
I'd love to see. There
yeah,
was one
would
going
around
of a badly made Ralph Lauren polo where the horse was riding the guy. It was really good. good.
Okay, but outside of Coco's love of bootleg fashion, our priority today is how to save the UK from a climate catastrophe. This week saw the world's average temperature reaching a new high. Scientists say that the reading was the highest in any record dating back to the end of the 19th century, with our Prime Minister being accused by his own colleagues of apathy on climate crisis. His government have been forced to deny it's planning to break its flagship £11.6 billion climate and nature funding pledge for developing countries. And Alok Sharma has tweeted, so hope the government is not planning to drop its climate finance pledge to some of the most vulnerable countries in the world. I was at the UN when Boris Johnson made this commitment to spontaneous applause. It was a proud moment for the UK. That's Conservative MP Alok Sharma, who was president for COP26 when it was held in Glasgow. So obviously, quite a high-profile Conservative who quite recently had a very important job within the context of the climate crisis. Didn't feel great for Rishi Sunak.
So there was a lot of outcry about the news that the government may be planning to break its pledge. Just Stop Oil tweeted, so who is going to put a number on how many deaths this will cause? It's time to call this government out as murderers, cutting climate aid to vulnerable countries, drilling for new oil and gas as more heat records shattered. We are witnessing a deliberate genocide. So coming up next, we'll be joined by our special guest, Chloe Naldret, who is spokesperson from Just Stop Oil. Record this on Wednesday, the Home Secretary Suella Braverman and Culture Secretary Lucy Fraser are meeting with leading sports bodies to discuss the threat of disruption by protesters from groups such as Just Stop Oil. Over the last few months, we've seen the orange powder paint fly at major events like the World Snooker Championships, the Chelsea Flower Show, the Lords Test Match, and last week's Pride March in London. With Wimbledon having just got underway and the British Grand Prix at Silverstone this weekend, the organisers are clearly getting jumpy.
Yesterday, the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak wrote an article in The Sun in which he labelled the protesters as Lords eco-zealots and praised England cricketer Johnny Bairstow for physically removing one of them from the pitch. Just to be clear, this is the same Rishi Sunak who failed to name the climate crisis as one of his five political priorities and who was accused by Zach Goldsmith, who quit as a Foreign Office Minister last week, of showing apathy towards the environment, who also was actually going to skip COP27 in Egypt last year, only to cave on that decision after immense public pressure.
So as another climate record tumbles last month, being the hottest June on record, who's going to save us? Because it isn't going to be this government. Maybe it could be our guest, Chloe Naldret. She's a theatre producer, a mum of two boys and a spokesperson for Just Stop Oil. Hello, Chloe. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in, Chloe. So this ends up being, by accident, particularly relevant day for you to come in because last week the government's climate change committee said that the government was missing the majority of its climate targets and had lost its position as a world leader on the climate. And this week, the Guardian and the BBC are reporting that the government's drawing up plans to drop the pledge it made when it hosted COP26 in 2019 to contribute £11.6 billion to the global fund set up to help developing nations who are most at risk from climate change. The government has issued a denial on this front, but are you starting to worry if Rishi Sunak actually believes in the climate crisis? Because, I mean, he talks a good game, but based on his actions, he's starting to feel like a climate denier.
Yeah, I think that's a totally fair reading of that situation. He just doesn't get it. And I think there's a question really, isn't there? Because they've got the best people briefing them on this. So they simply cannot be unaware. It's just that he simply doesn't want to get it. He doesn't want to face it. He's not brave enough to look at it, what it means for the country and on a personal level for his children. So, you know, I genuinely think that there's a sort of an absolute abdication of responsibility coming from him on this, on a political level and on a personal level. And like you say, every time you look at the news, every time you open a paper, there is a story about the climate crisis or about our lack of response to the climate crisis, which makes the existence of Just Stop Oil absolutely fundamentally essential because no one is pushing back against the government on this except us.
With someone like Rishi Sunak, I'm sure there's a more erudite way of me asking this question, but do you think he's just too fucking rich to give a shit? Because if there, you know, he's probably got some land in New Zealand that he's squirreling. to hide his children when the everything goes Mad Max?
Well, I think that's probably happening to an awful lot of people who live in, you know, with extreme wealth, whether it's Darren Woods, the CEO of Exxon, who earns $24 million a year plus his bonuses from a business practice which is destroying our future. You know, they know that. The oil companies, they know that. The governments, they know it because the UN has been really, really clear about what's happening. So this idea that they're insulated from the problem, I think you're probably getting at what the pathology of it is. Oh, you know, that's for other people. It's not for me. We'll be all right. But, you know, what's coming? The social breakdown, the weather events, the absolutely catastrophic consequences of this are going to affect all of us. Whether they affect us, you know, directly in not being able to afford our shopping or in having our house burnt down, or whether they affect us because we're simply not safe in our homes and in our society anymore, or because our infrastructure is crumbling around us. So it is just absolutely staggering ignorance. And I do think it's pathological.
There is this kind of resistance to engage with it. And certainly Just Stop Oil provoke a lot of fingers in ears. Stop it, stop it, stop it. I've actually got an example of it now that I want to play for you. I'm very sorry. You have to sit through this. For our listeners, we're going to play Chloe a clip of her recent appearance on Piers Morgan's show on Talk TV.
The more of these things you do are things that I enjoy and my friends enjoy and my family enjoys and other people with their friends and families enjoy, the more families that you stop in getting to work or getting their kids to school for important exams or getting to funerals or whatever it may be, the more you do that, the more we hate you and the more we don't want to have anything to do with you or give you a platform to talk about the stuff that actually is more important, as you rightly say. Why don't you just stop the stupid stunts? Stop wrecking
because
people's lives.
This won't stay in the news and it won't stay in the conversation. And perhaps what we're doing by interrupting the things that you need to do that are important to you, that you love, is we're making you think about everything that we're standing
to lose. No, you're not. You're making me think you're a bunch of morons.
Lord Deben said today...
You're not, Chloe.
Lord Deben said today...
Chloe, you're not making me think about your cause. Nobody at Lords today was thinking, God, you know what? This is about climate change. We saw the orange powder, the whole crowd started booing. Unfortunately, England's wicketkeeper, Johnny Bairstow.
Are you going to let me talk?
Actually, no, I'm going to cut you off. I'm going to go to Sir Geoffrey Boycott. Geoffrey.
It's very painful to watch that. I watched the whole thing. It's like 20 minutes long. It's horrible. There's a line here, by the way, at the beginning before he introduces Chloe, where he talks about the attention seeking and wrecking of stuff that other people enjoy. And I thought, you're talking about you, Piers? That sounds like a description of you. But seriously, how did you feel watching that?
That is the first time I've seen any of it back, because I just thought, I don't need to watch that back just yet. The funny thing is about Piers, you can't take it personally, because it's not personal to me. It's just generalized hatred towards people who are doing the stuff that he disagrees with. And because I think there's also something pathological going on there, he just simply won't listen to anybody. That's not what his program is about. It's not about listening to anyone. It's not about learning. It's not about sharing views. It's literally just about shouting at people. And I thought, you know, I don't think I need to watch back being shouted at like that. But yeah, it's the staggering thing about it is that it's just the lack of vision and the lack of seeing what's absolutely obvious. And I had to stand there while he and Geoffrey Boycott sort of ranted on about, well, the integrity of the cricket pitch. And you're going, what about the integrity of the planet that we live on and our ecosystems and our crops? And what about the integrity of our water supply? What about the integrity of the temperatures that we need to live in? You know, it's just so willfully blind.
It's interesting as well, because the narrative that people use about Just Stop Oil was like, oh, they're ramming it down our throats. But then you watch all the clips and you barely get a word in and everyone's shouting at you. It's just a strange... To see it play out like that, it's quite jarring. And I'm sure it was more so for you.
Well, it's just very frustrating.
Also, as a cricket fan, I think whilst he's a wonderful batsman, the protester is just about the only thing Johnny Bairstow hasn't dropped in this test series so far. That's a very specific test cricket
joke. I wasn't sure, but I gave the sportsman response, which I believe is, well.
I think it's really interesting thinking about what would have happened if the cricketers on the pitch had stopped and stood there and let the protest happen. You know, what was it, 5 minutes? 5 minutes that match was disrupted before they got back on and carried on playing. What if they'd stood there? What if they'd applauded? What if they'd, you know, supported the people taking that action? How would that have changed the narrative? How would that have changed the public discourse? What are the opportunities here for sports people who are finding themselves in this kind of situation, because we're all affected and we've all got a part to play.
Can I ask you, and I myself have been on a journey with this, like I did Question Time a few times, once with Piers Morgan, and, you know, and I felt that I had some obligation to do it. Now I've gone the other way and thought maybe I shouldn't participate in those kind of conversations. Is there value in going on those shows?
Yeah, I think there is. At the moment I came off it, I went, right, I'm never doing that again. I'm never going on there to be shouted at like that again. That's awful. And then I phoned Donica afterwards, who's also part of that interview. Yeah. And he said, look, it's useful. It's so useful every single time, because otherwise they're going to have the conversation without us.
Yeah.
So they're just going to do the shouting without even the 30 seconds that I might have got in about, you know, what's going on and the government's failure to act. But he said that anything that you do that sows a little tiny seed of doubt in the presenter's mind or in the mind of the people watching, every single little bit of reminder that you get that you go, this is real, this is happening now,
yeah,
and we can prevent it because we're causing it. Every single opportunity to do that is worthwhile.
I just yesterday just typed in just stop oil into Google, right? Just to see, you know, what was going on. And then you click on the news tab and it gives you all the headlines. And the headlines were mad. Yeah. One of them was from the BBC and the headline literally said, just stop oil, what is it and what does it want? I don't know if you've seen the name, but
there's a big clue.
There's a clue about what it wants. And it was kind of, you know, like I'm a journalist myself. I sometimes try and take with a pinch of salt, the idea of like the mainstream media's against people. But when I saw those headlines written out like that,
it really is. Yeah, yeah.
It was all very one note, one side. Do you feel this is that this tactic can eventually cut through this?
Well, I think the question is, what are we trying to achieve? And obviously the main demand is that we need the government to not license the 100 new oil and gas fields and open the blinking coal mine that they're trying to open, like this is the, you know, 1870s. That's the really clear demand. But, you know, what we're not trying to do is get the right-wing media to go, God, Just Stop Oil, they're so amazing, what great guys. You know, if that was the aim, this is not how we'd go about it, and we would be spectacularly failing. The point is, we are just there to make sure that this conversation is happening every day in every possible cultural space. And we are achieving that. And like you say, the amount of media that we had like last week was absolutely off the charts. It was astonishing. There is no environmental campaign group that has ever achieved this kind of consistent media presence where, you know, I read an article about Wimbledon yesterday that actually led with just people are being screened to make sure that they're not Just Stop Oil protesters on the way in, and is Just Stop Oil going to disrupt Wimbledon? We haven't done anything yet.
Yeah.
You know? But suddenly it's at the top of the conversation. And that's not because we want attention. And believe me, it's not because we enjoy doing this stuff. It's so stressful. And, you know, the stress of doing these actions and then of court and of the possibility of fines and prison sentences, it's mentally and physically really demanding. But we're doing it because we don't know what else to do. Mm. You know, the situation is absolutely desperate. And this is working because this is changing the public discourse around it, even if it's we hate you, but actually we probably have got a point about the oil and gas fields.
Because that is the concern, right? It's because the way that the narrative around Just Stop Oil is shaped is hugely done by hostile elements of the press. You're happy for people to have a negative view of Just Stop Oil as an organisation, as long as they absorb something of the substantive message?
There are people who are, you know, typing Just Stop Oil into a search engine, which I highly recommend you do, and finding where they can come to a talk and they can hear more about what we're trying to achieve and why, or they can sign up to join us on one of the marches that we're doing every day in London. So there will always be people who will find us out because they're sat at home going, I'm really scared and I need to do something. So they're there anyway. We're not going to get broad public support, but that's all right because we're not trying to get elected and it's not a popularity contest. So that's fine. The most important thing is that our government feels the pressure that makes it do the right thing to protect us now and in the future.
And to be clear, the demands are, I know you've already said it, but I think it's worth restating. Mm. It's quite a specific thing.
The brilliant thing about it is that it is a very, very clear demand. You know, Just Stop Oil, what we're saying is we cannot license any new oil and gas. We're not saying shut oil off tomorrow because that would be impractical and that would not be a just transition. And the people who are already at the front line of all the front lines that are happening in this country right now, which are all related to the crisis one way or another, they would be the people that suffer first and worst. So we're not saying switch it off overnight. We're saying we need to start the transition with 7 or 8 years worth of oil that we already have. Mm. And we need to go, that's our target. That's our target to be transitioned towards an energy economy, which is built on sustainable, renewable, clean energy sources. So that's what it is. And of course, the thing is that there are so many things that we need to do all around the world to combat the climate emergency and the biodiversity loss that is just going to be absolutely catastrophic for all of us and is catastrophic for people now. But we won't get to do any of those things unless we stop the harm. And the harm is coming from our burning of fossil fuels.
I wanted to ask you about your own personal journey. What was your moment that you were like, I have to drop everything and do this now? Was there like an epiphany?
There was for me. There was a moment when I really engaged with the very discomforting truth about what the climate crisis means for my children. And that was a really sort of distressing moment for me. And everything that I've done since is basically about trying to run as fast as I can away from how that made me feel.
So, what was the moment?
I was standing in the shower, and I just thought, it was a beautiful day outside, and I just had this moment of, what if I can't feed my kids? What if I can't keep them safe? The climate crisis is the biggest threat to law and order that the world will ever have seen. Because what do people do when they can't eat? What do people do when there's not enough drinking water? What do people do when their homes aren't habitable? What if I can't keep my children safe anymore? And what would that ask of me as a parent? And that the thought of that is horrific. And I think until people go somewhere like that, your version of whatever that is, the threat to the things that you love most, I think you don't connect with the crisis emotionally, because we all know it intellectually. Even the people who are denying it, they know it intellectually, and that is a form of going, oh God, I can't deal with how that makes me feel. So, but until we really consider it on that personal level, I think it's very difficult to comprehend because it's so massive.
And you went to prison for it, right?
I did.
What was that like?
I'm a white, straight, middle-aged, quite middle-class woman. I'm cisgendered. I'm employed. I'm able-bodied. I'm of sound mind. My mental health is strong. Prison was not difficult for me on a personal level.
How long were you in for?
I was only in for a week. I did a week in Foston Hall in Derbyshire. Had a lovely lady who was also on the action that we took at Kingsbury Oil Terminal.
Yeah, because
she was there with me.
What was actually the reason you went to prison?
Yeah, we broke an injunction. So what's happening at the moment is civil law, as opposed to criminal law, is being manipulated by the companies that can afford to pay for these things called injunctions. So all the oil terminals in the country have taken out these injunctions, which prevent anyone protesting on their land, prevent people from blocking roads. We went to Kingsbury Oil Terminal just outside Birmingham, and we sat in the road at the front of that oil terminal in defiance of that injunction, and were therefore then all held on remand for a week before we could go into court and be sentenced.
You weren't actually breaking any laws, to be clear.
We weren't breaking any laws of the country. Yeah. We were breaking a private law that has been taken out by an oil company against ordinary people.
Which is interesting because, lots of the criticism against Just Stop Oil is, why don't you go to the oil companies? Well,
we
that's
do.
Why.
And, yeah. and 51 of us went to prison for a week, and some stayed somewhere in a bit longer than that. And, the beautiful Guardian covered it, but no one else did, So you go, well, that doesn't work. It doesn't work when we do that. It doesn't get the coverage. So, yeah, it was a week in Foston Hall for a week. I was with a lovely lady from the action so that, the two of us really looked after each other. But the shocking thing for me, as someone who has never, prior to any of this, had any connection to and any engagement with the criminal justice system whatsoever, the shocking thing for me was meeting the other women that were in there. And I was like, I was still on action mode. So I talked to everybody. They're there because they're poor. They're there because they are in grinding generational deprivation. And they're committing the kind of crimes that people commit because they're poor. And it's the shocking thing about it was the level of illiteracy and the level of mental health issues and just the sort of social issues that are being suffered by the women that are in there with absolutely no support. There's a woman opposite me in the cell who's having 6-hour-long psychotic episodes between her meds, and she just left in there on her own. So, you know, for me, it wasn't a big deal, but witnessing that, that has absolutely fundamentally changed who I am and how I respond to the issues that are going on in our society.
When you were in there and you talked about the environment, did it register with people?
Oh, yeah, they were absolutely fascinated because they were brilliant because, you know, those women are in there all day, every day. Some of them are for really long sentences. So they're really up for a chat. They were like, why are all you posh girls in here? And explained. And they're like, oh, right, yeah, that's really important because, you know, they know they're at the front line. When they're in that old, poorly insulated prison, it's really hot in the summer and uncomfortable. And they were like, yeah, it's really bad. It was really bad here when it hit 40 degrees. And then when they're there in the winter, they're absolutely freezing. Mm. So, you know, they know that because they're experiencing at the sharp end what's going on.
So with the reason I wanted to ask you that is because, again, in how Justa Poyle was characterised sometimes, it's this idea that the public are against them. But, you know, I know a couple of Justa Poyle protesters and they do say, yes, it's bad, you know, getting spat at, pushed, shoved, but also some huge amounts of love and praise from just complete strangers.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could share some of that as well.
Yeah, that's the thing that the media doesn't like to report on. So when we go on programmes like that, they tend to show pictures of us out on the roads, being interacted with in a negative way by drivers and by passers-by, because that's great news, right? That's a nice bit of conflict and sparks a discussion. What they're not showing is the people who stop and applaud and the people who, you know, burst into tears and say thank you for doing what you're doing. And then the people who stop and have a conversation and then subsequently, you know, might go and join up and join us on another march another time. There was a really amazing story from one of the early daily marches sort of back in the end of April, where somebody came along earlier in the day and ripped banners and was really angry and verbally abused the people who were walking along the street, and then came back the following day and apologised and said, I've looked into what you're doing and it's really great, and stopped and had a cup of tea with them.
Oh,
wow.
Where's that story being told? You know, because that's also
beautiful.
What's happening.
Just as an aside, we had someone write into us who had a small one-man protest, not about the environment, but about voter ID.
Yeah.
And people brought him tea. And I don't know why, but there's just something about that, like the beautiful activist cup of tea circle. Yeah. I think we can all just solve this. We all just need to have some good cups of tea.
The lovely thing within the activist community, which it really is a community, is that there's a huge amount of self-care and love for each other, because we all understand the pressure that we're under of putting ourselves in these situations and what that feels like. Mm. And so there is just this lovely familial feeling. And the amazing thing is we're all completely different. You know, there is, I know there's a media stereotype out there, but it's totally inaccurate, because we're people from completely different walks of life. And this whole confected narrative that we are the enemies of working people, we are working people. We're actually your neighbours. Mm. And when we all get together, which doesn't happen very often, but it's beautiful when it does, you really see that, because we are just a cross-section of society.
I do want to ask you about politics, given that we are a political podcast. Mm. Is there any party you'd back to look after the environment at this moment in time?
Well, the interesting thing is that as a result of these protests, or maybe just as a result of good sense and reading the UN's report on climate change, perhaps, every political party in this country, with the exception of the Conservatives, has backed the No New Oil pledge and has turned that into their policy. So, you know, and Keir Starmer reiterated that a few weeks ago. Whoever gets in next is going to need their feet held to the fire, because there is big, difficult work to do. And politicians, as we've seen, you know, Tories have been in 13 years. They haven't wanted to engage with any of this. In fact, they've gone backwards. So anyone who comes in next is going to need to be held to account.
Does that mean Justa Poyle will disband?
No. Well, it depends. It depends. We're only here as long as we're necessary.
Yeah.
So if the next government is doing what it needs to do in respect of stopping new oil and gas licences, then, you know, then this campaign won't be necessary anymore. And it'd be lovely to think we'd get to that point.
You're just there being like, please, we don't want this job anymore.
I'd love to go home and back to my job. It'd be really nice.
Have you had to take a hiatus from your job?
No, I'm still working. So I did take some unpaid leave when I went and did the Kingsbury action and went to prison.
In terms of like, we're already talking about next governments because, I mean, there's a pretty widespread sense. This lot are not going to be hanging around for very long. But unfortunately, because of the nature of our electoral system, there's a chance that the election could be held as late as January 2025. And, you know, one of the messages that we're constantly getting is time's running out, time's running out, time's running out. Is there a message in the interim that you would like to deliver to Rishi Sunak? Given that he could be Prime Minister for, you know, at least another year and a half.
I think the key thing with Rishi Sunak is he's clearly incapable of dealing with this as a politician. I'd like him to think about it as a parent. I'd like him to think about his responsibility to his two children, to his girls, and consider what he can be doing on their behalf if he won't consider it on our behalf. So I would really like him to consider what his responsibility is as a father. Because if we all thought about what we could do as an individual, then we would already be halfway to solving this problem. And he has the power to do some really good, important things. And he'll have to be brave and it won't be comfortable. Mm-hmm. But if he does think about what this means for his children, I think his decisions might be different.
He obviously as an individual has a huge amount of power. The problem, sometimes the thing that I feel about it is completely powerless and hopeless.
Yeah.
I think that sometimes when you read a lot of the information about where we're going, while we're just demanding that you give messages out to individuals or groups.
It's like a weird version of Cameo, isn't it?
I'm here for this. This is great.
what's the message you... How do you warn people off despair?
Because it's quite paralysing, despair.
Yeah.
If you think it's inevitable, it is hard to get up and stay motivated.
Yeah, despair is an inactive emotion.
Yeah.
So you've got to get from despair to hope, and hope is an active emotion. And not you know, crossing your fingers and wishing it'll all turn out, but actually truly what active hope is. I think there'll be so many people who are listening to this who feel as I did, this is really scary and I don't know what to do. And I would just urge those people to find other people.
Yeah.
Whether you want to come and join Just Stop All, and I promise you'll be welcomed with open arms if you do. Whether you feel like Extinction Rebellion, which has moved into this more sort of community, grassroots, joining organisations up, really important work. If you feel that's the place for you, go there. If you feel it's Greenpeace or Parents for Future or Friends of the Earth, just go and find other people who are where you are at in terms of thinking this is awful and who are where you are at in terms of what you're prepared to put on the line for it. And that is the antidote to the despair. Mm. Every single time, finding other people who share your concerns but are prepared to work with you to do something about it. And anyone that thinks that an individual cannot make a difference has simply never tried.
I have one question.
Yeah, yeah.
How are you as a person? Because, like, this kind of stuff is hard and it does take a toll on the individual. And, you know, you're a activist and a campaigner, but you're also a human being. And are you feeling all right?
Thank you for asking, and I might cry. I am, because this gives me a lot back.
Right.
This is so much better for me than sitting with that despair and that feeling of I can't do anything and that worry. This is so much better. But it is hard, you know. It's hard reading all the reports. It's hard reading all the newspaper articles. You know, before I had that sort of awful vision about what it was going to mean for my kids, I used to read the headlines and go, I don't want to read that. I don't want to know.
Yeah.
And now I do read it. And I have to hold all of that information. And it's hard and it's heavy. But I don't feel like I do it alone anymore. And I do feel like there's people who are looking out for me. And I do feel this enormous sort of swell of love and support from not just from the activist community, but from, you know, my network. Mm. You know, when I go out and do Piers Morgan, I get all these messages from people going, "Hope you're okay. It's so horrible." You know, and that is really helpful because I know that what I'm doing is being seen and appreciated, and it is changing the way people think.
And I think also, I'm going to have my philosophy moment.
Here we go.
I was telling to Anish about it earlier, actually, that I once went to a philosophy class. And it was all about, like, logic and, I don't know, to be honest with you, Chloe, I didn't really get it. But one of my takeaways from it was this idea that, like, you should always be sure to make a distinction between likely and inevitable. Because actually inevitable, logically, is very, 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 yeah, very, very, very rare, extremely rare. What you're talking more about is likely. And I always thought to myself, well, as long as things that are bad are not inevitable, there's always a way. There's always a way forward. And as long as you can hang on to that, you can keep motivated, you know? And yeah, even with this climate catastrophe, there is still a way. We can still live well on this country, on this planet. It's not, because I know people are talking about, oh, it's the point of no return, but there's still a way we can do this, right?
Well, there's still everything to fight for, because the reality is it's not like there's going to come one day and everything shuts down,
yeah,
and it's all over. We have to fight for every single fraction of a degree of global warming, because every single tenth of a degree represents the livability for millions and millions of people. So, you know, even if we do hit a point where the scientists say, well, we've passed 1.5 degrees, we've basically passed it this year, is the absolute truth of that. Then we start to lose control of some of those climate systems and the ecosystem collapse. We still have to keep fighting, because there will, you know, that won't mean that everything is shut down. It will just mean that we lose some things. But the reality is that we sort of got till the end of this decade. And if we absolutely go at it, frankly, if we went at it, if our government went at it with the zeal for which it's going for environmental protesters, we'd be fine. You know, if they were spending time, you know, having interministerial conversations about how we solve the crisis rather than how we deal with the fire alarm, then we'd be all right. So that's why it is so important that we mobilise everybody.
And if not everybody only the climate was a migrant, then they would just care more.
I think the fact that the phrase "they're more worried about the fire alarm than the fire" is so good. That's the whole thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the whole thing.
Thank you so much for your time, Chloe. This has been so thought provoking and inspirational. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chloe.
Thank you.
Hey, it's John. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics about how to fix this mess. We're doing it again, November 5th through the 7th in Washington, D.C. with even more podcast panels and workshops. Plus, there will be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get your tickets at CrookedCon.com, where we'll also announce the lineup. If you're a Friends of the Pod subscriber, a limited number of discounted tickets are still available. Get them before they run out. See you at CrookedCon.
Okay. It's been another tricky week for Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister at time of recording. Yet more divisions have appeared within his party. Backbenchers have launched their own immigration plan, of which we will talk more in a moment. But he was also given a grilling by the Crossbench Commons Liaison Committee, which is a sort of super committee made up of the chairs of the other Commons committees. And it's something that every Prime Minister is expected to do twice a year.
Mm-hmm. So questions range from the economy, immigration, NHS to Ukraine and Israel. He was given a particularly thorough going over. That makes that sound a bit saucy there. Sorry, just that line there. Oh, all right. By Labour MP Chris Bryant, who forced him to admit... Oh, should I do it again, just in case?
I don't mind. I don't mind you bringing a bit of blue to this. And I'm not talking about the Tory party.
All right, let's stick with it. He was given a particularly thorough going over by Labour MP Chris Bryant, who forced him to admit he hadn't read the report from the Privileges Committee, which criticised a number of Tory MPs for undermining its authority over its report into Boris Johnson misleading Parliament. Chris Bryant also grilled the PM over his plans to miss the next two prime minister's questions and missing votes on potential punishments for Boris Johnson and the former minister, Owen Paterson.
You didn't turn up for the Owen Paterson votes at all. That's right, isn't it?
I can't recall.
You didn't turn up for the Boris Johnson votes at all, did you?
No, I was at a charity dinner for Jewish care.
I think that's some cutting it fine, I would argue, since other members of Parliament who were at the same dinner with you and left after you did manage to get back for the vote.
With greatest respect, I think their role and my role at the dinner probably slightly different.
You chose not to be there, didn't you? That's twice, on two rule-breaking moments, you chose not to be in Parliament. But yesterday, you opined on the rules of cricket.
Oh, God, the thing I disliked from that whole situation there was Rishi Sunak just smiling the whole time.
Do you want to do that again? Because he said Sunak. It felt like a Freudian slip. That you're so bored by him that you tried to sneak the word snooze into his surname.
It doesn't not work, does it?
It doesn't not work. Snooze-nack.
Snooze-nack. What I really disliked about that episode there, that exchange, was that Rishi Sunak had a shameless smirk on his face the entire time.
Yeah, and I think, I can understand how you might look at this and think, well, at the end of the day, this feels a bit sort of inside Westminster, who attended what votes, who did this. But I think the reason that it really matters is because of the stall Rishi Sunak has set out and the platform that he is aiming to win the next election on. And now a chunk of that is just general culture war and sort of personal attacks on Keir Starmer. But another facet of that is he has set his stall out as being the antidote to Boris Johnson. So he has set himself up as a person of integrity, maybe a little dull at points, but a technocrat who's focused on detail. And so I think the problem for him here is that he hasn't read a report into whether members of his own party may have been damaging the political process and democratic accountability in this country. And he didn't attend two votes about the integrity of the former prime minister, again, who comes from his party, under whose tenure he served as chancellor. So I think that this contradicts Rishi Sunak's own image that he's trying to sell to the public of a details-oriented person who has immense personal integrity. And that also matters because the only other thing he set his stall out on is these five pledges, which at the time were criticised for being so low in their expectations that it was almost impossible to not fulfil them, and he hasn't fulfilled any of them.
Yeah.
So he's not delivering anything substantive on a policy front, and he's not delivering on his promise to be a details-focused politician of immense integrity.
You know what?
He's a fucking waste of space.
I wanted to tell you about this new band that I'm sure you're going to love. They're called the New Conservatives, and they have all your favourite players in it, but the music's even more shit. Have you heard of them? Have you seen their first album?
Yes, I did see this. This was the website launch on Monday of a new group of new conservatives.
Track list includes We Hate Migrants.
Tom Hunt, one of the MPs who's part of the group, said he sees the group focusing on three main issues: migration, law and order, and what they see as the threat to Britain from woke ideas. And you're like, how is this the new conservatives? It doesn't seem to be hugely different from the old conservatives. But Miriam Cates is another MP, gave a speech at the event saying it was time to make our borders culturally secure. Oh, hello, Miriam. I see the dogs assembling from the dog whistle you just blew. Culturally secure. Oh, what in the name of Enoch Powell has happened here? I mean, they're calling on the government to dramatically reduce migration. They say they want to see net migration fall from 606,000 to 240,000 before the end of 2024, which the report argues could be achieved, get this, Coco, by measures including slashing temporary care worker visas. And I'll tell you, if there's one section in Britain that has too many workers, it's the care section. People in care have had it too good for too long.
This is what I mean. I thought the Conservatives are meant to love old people. That's their voter base. That is predominantly going to impact elderly care.
They want this to happen before the end of 2024. As I'm saying this, I feel that I'm wasting my breath.
And it's
because
weird, isn't it?
Why are we trying to speak logically to these people?
Part of our job on this podcast is, you know, when Labour make their promises, to be like, yes, but where will the money come from? And there's a part of me that's like, I don't care. Just find the money. Rob the bank. I don't care. Do what you've got to do, man. Like, just find it. Because, I mean, if you were to do nothing, there would be a diminishing service as people leave. But then these guys are here, just out here with axes, trying to cut down every little sapling of hope we have left in it.
But look, it's bad news for Sunak, because this is more dissenting voices coming from the right of his party, and that's a section of the party that maybe didn't want him in place in the first place. And, you know, I personally have no faith in the Conservative Party's ability to deal with its most extreme elements, only because in the last 13 years, the story of British politics is the right, hard right of the Conservative Party wants something and it gets it.
Just on this new Conservatives business, it speaks to an email we've had in from a US listener. He's called Nathan. Hi, Nathan. And he says, as an outsider looking in, Suella Braverman seems to be both racist, incompetent, and maybe not the brightest star in the firmament. So my question is, how is she Home Secretary if she seems so ill-suited? Is it the least coveted ministerial position? Is it that they had to put her somewhere? Or is it that she was essentially appointed to destroy the ministry from within?
Well, I think, again, for international listeners, it's worth considering Suella Braverman's recent career. So in October of 2022, she left her cabinet position as Home Secretary. And she said the departure was because she had made an honest mistake by sharing an official document from her personal email address with a colleague in Parliament, which sort of breaches our ministerial code. She kind of resigned. And then that was the 19th of October, 2022. On the 25th of October, 2022, so a grand total of 6 days later, she was reappointed to the same job by Rishi Sunak. Now, the widespread assumption is that Rishi Sunak guaranteed her that job back if she supported him in his campaign to be leader, and not Boris Johnson, who she'd been a very close and public political ally of. And that was a way of ensuring that Johnson didn't have enough votes from MPs to stand against Sunak. And if he'd had to stand against Sunak, the votes would have gone to the Conservative members, who had already rejected Rishi Sunak in favour of Liz Truss and seemed to be the last people in Britain to still have anything approaching a high opinion of Boris Johnson. So she is very specifically in that job as a way of quietening down this right-wing fringe of the Conservative Party. And again, this goes back to what I was saying. The tail is wagging the dog. And unfortunately, the tail is doing what looks uncomfortably like a sea kyle towards Germany in the 1930s. So Suella Braverman is in that job essentially not because she's qualified, but because she appeases a small section of the Conservative Party. And those are the people who, unfortunately, are running the country.
So we interrupt this podcast because Nish and I have just received a news alert, not just special for us. I think many people who have news apps would have received the same one, that Just Stop Oil have protested at Wimbledon.
Yeah, I'm just watching footage now. It's a game between Sho Shimabukuro and Gregor Dimitrov. Dimitrov's about to go to serve on court 18 in Wimbledon, and two JSO protesters have run on and thrown sort of what looks like orange confetti on the court. There's a lot of booing from people who I guess were very excited to see some action on court 18. They're scattering bits of orange confetti across the court.
Yeah, and so we had the pleasure of speaking to Chloe Neldrecht, who is a spokesperson for Just Stop Oil, earlier. She'd actually left the studio. This happened, and we pretty much just chased her and asked her to come back. So thanks for doing that, Chloe.
My pleasure.
I mean, I've got to ask, did you know this was coming?
I didn't know it was coming, but I'm not terribly surprised that it's coming.
Yeah.
You know, we are engaged in civil resistance and taking every possible opportunity to bring maximum attention to the cause. And of course, Wimbledon is one of the biggest sporting events in the diary. So I'm not surprised to see that it's happened.
It's hard to not acknowledge the reaction of the crowd. There's a lot of booing. Mm. how do you feel about that reaction?
Well, I think it's unsurprising, isn't it? Because it's interrupting people's enjoyment of something. And in the moment, that is really annoying and frustrating. We all know whether you're being held up in traffic or whether you've gone to watch a sporting event and it's had to stop for some reason. It is really annoying. But we're looking at a disproportionate amount of disruption that is coming for all of us. So the disruption to a sporting fixture for, let's face it, probably 5-10 minutes in order to draw attention to the crisis, really isn't the biggest deal.
Mm. This protest had a variation from the iconic orange powder. Just wondered if you could explain for our listeners about the confetti.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that. I don't know what's being used there. It will be something that's non-toxic and it will be biodegradable. It won't be harmful at all. Like the poster paint is actually cornflour with food colouring in it. So there's absolutely you could eat it basically.
Right,
there's no toxic risk. But I do know that Wimbledon has stepped up its bag searches, and are confiscating anything that could conceivably have looked like orange poster paint. So
right.
I imagine they had to evolve. I mean, that's what we're doing. We're
the reports
evolve.
Are that it's jigsaw pieces and confetti, and there's an official statement from Just Stop Oil saying we can't leave it to the next generation to pick up the pieces, which is, that's solid wordplay, man.
It's really good, isn't it?
Jigsaw pieces. We can't leave
really
it.
Really literal.
That's solid.
And I've just had a look at the press release, and the two individuals that took action, the two supporters of Just Stop Oil who've taken this action, are grandparents. They're concerned for the future of their grandchildren, and we all get that, don't we? I was looking at a picture the other day of my dad with my two children, and it just made me think: Are I ever going to see? Is there ever going to be a picture of my children with their grandchildren? Are they going to have the privilege of grandchildren? So it's very moving when you think about the kind of sacrifices that are being made for our kids, for our next generations.
Gorgeous.
Thanks, Chloe. So, a number of you have scolded us for leaving out heroes and villains from last week's episode, including, to be absolutely fair, my mother, who also called me to say, where was heroes and villains? But we needed to make room for John Humphreys' great stories. There was a lot of love for him in the inbox, right?
Yes, lots of love for Mr. Humphreys in our inbox, including this from @TribbleChibi. They commented on YouTube to say, I've never heard of John Humphreys, but I'm already writing up a petition to make him my new granddad. So if you're also in need of a surrogate grandparent, you can listen back to John Humphreys on last week's episode. It's episode 9 on our feed. And we did actually put our last week's hero and villain on social media, so that's your fault for not following. You can find us at Pod Save the UK on Twitter.
Okay, so Coco, tell us who you've chosen as this week's PSUK villain of the week.
Yes, so I'm going to go for the Rail Delivery Group. They represent train companies and they're planning to close hundreds of ticket offices in stations across England over the next 3 years. As you know, transport is my thing. I feel very passionately about it. But for me, I think this speaks to a problem with who is designing our world.
Mm-hmm.
This decision was clearly made by someone, designed by someone or some people who have never experienced poverty, who certainly aren't elderly and certainly not disabled. Probably we kind of know what the decision makers look like because, there's lots of people who won't be able to use an app and might need help, I mean, the amount of times if you need to get onto an app and you're not on a contract phone, if you just pay as you go, you run out of data. I just think it's really sad and it makes me absolutely furious. Also, just on a personal level, those apps break. They break all the time. Those machines break all the time. So there's actually a lot of people who just, that's not going to work for them,
Yeah, it is interesting how many decisions are now being made on the assumption that every single person interacting with every single thing they need to interact with to get through their day-to-day lives has access to the internet on a mobile phone that has credit on it, and then they're also able to pay for things on their bank card.
Yeah.
And again, there's the assumption around a cashless society does exclude a lot of unhoused people, recent immigrants, undocumented people that, are part of the economy and lifeblood of the country and are people too and have the right to use these things.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, please take us out on a positive note with your hero of the week.
I've gone for a trailblazer in the sport of football, which for our American listeners, you now know as that thing Ted Lasso does. Hannah Dingley, 30 years after the show, the manageress imagined the actress Sherry Lungi as the first woman to take charge of a men's team. Hannah has made history as the first ever woman to manage a professional men's team in the top four leagues of English football. She's been put in caretaker charge of the first team at Forest Green Rovers in League Two after the club sacked former Everton and Scotland striker Duncan Ferguson. She took the Forest Green first team for training for the first time on Tuesday, and she'll be in charge for tonight's friendly at non-league Melksham Town, and she's expected to continue to lead pre-season preparations.
I think the important thing as well is that sort of role modelling for other female coaches, other young girls that are growing up knowing that anything is possible if you work hard enough and opportunities do come along. Almost my biggest concern in a way is that this isn't a gimmick. This isn't about this. This is about those players in that changing room. And this is about them getting the preparation that they need for that campaign. And I would like that nothing takes away from that. Because if it does, then it's probably the wrong thing to do to put me in this position in the first place, because they're the priority and the team are the priority. And this isn't, a gimmick. This is because we need to do the best things for those footballers and our football club.
Look, there's absolutely no reason why an eminently qualified woman shouldn't be able to coach a men's football team. Nobody seems to have any problem with it the other way around. Phil Neville was in charge of the England women's team, despite having a somewhat insubstantial coaching CV. And, you know, it was in fact his successor, a woman, Serena Wiegman, who actually brought England a football trophy for the first time since 1966 when the women won the Euros. So I can't see any reason why this shouldn't happen more often. And it's also very difficult to be the first person through the door in any way. So you have to salute Hannah Dingley. It's incredible.
Is Phil Neville's not the mini retirement one, is he?
No, that's Gary.
Oh, right. Okay.
This weekend, I'm going to Spain Friday till Monday morning. That's like a mini retirement. So
that's a weekend.
It's a weekend. It's a mini retirement.
I think about that daily. That very much lives in my mind rent-free.
I think he, based on an interview I heard with him last week,
yeah.
I think he gets reminded about that daily by the other people. I've seen multiple... He's on a live tour at the moment of The Overlap, which is his like YouTube web series, and basically it gets brought up every 5 minutes.
Did you know how our guest was talking about, like, oh, Just Stop Oil, everyone's, like, obsessing about it, and that's why they've almost done a good job, you know? Just Stop Oil was living in politicians' minds rent-free. That's a good thing to have in your mind, rent-free, not mini retirement, which is what I've got. I think about it all the time.
Thanks to everybody who's got in touch this week. You can get in touch with us by emailing psuk@reducedlistening.co.uk, or you can even send us a voice note on WhatsApp. Our number is 07514 644 572. Internationally, that's +44 7514 644 572. If you're new to the show, remember to hit follow on your app and you'll get a new episode every week.
And just finally, little favour. The British Podcast Awards has a public vote, the listener's choice. And if you'd like to vote for us, you know, it's not mandatory, but it would be good. And it's also free and easy to do. So please just go to www.britishpodcastawards.com/voting. Anyone can vote. So again, you just go to that website, britishpodcastawards.com/voting, and you just type in the little box there, Pod Save the UK.
Remember, as a show, we encourage people to vote as often as possible.
Pod Save the UK is a Reduced Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer Musty Aziz and digital producer Alex Bishop.
Video editing was by Will Darkin and the music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Thanks to our engineer David Dagahi.
The executive producers are Louise Cotton, Dan Jackson, Madeline Herringer and Michael Martinez.
Watch us on the Pod Save the World YouTube channel. Follow us on Twitter and TikTok, where we're at Pod Save the UK, or on Instagram through the Crooked Media channel.
And hit subscribe for new shows every Thursday on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Keep it, listeners. Louis Fertel here. I have something I've been dying to get off my chest. Dr. Robbie is the real villain of The Pit. There, I said it. Okay, but that's not actually the big news. Here's the big news. Emmy-nominated television host Nina Parker is officially the new co-host of Keep It. Woo-hoo. That's the confession. The Dr. Robbie thing was just, you know, me needing to say it somewhat out loud.
Okay, shots fired, and I hear you're Dr. Robbie, and I raise you. Sex in the City wasn't really a show about finding love. It was a humiliation ritual on bad friendships. The clothes were cute, though.
Oh, yeah, the tutu in the opening credits,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, it's really cute.
Every week, Nina and I will bring you an inside look at all the pop culture drama, the hottest takes you can handle, and honestly, maybe some you can't. Plus, celebrity guests galore.
We're going to guide you through gorgeous wreckage of pop culture. We are unpacking the biggest stories in TV, film, entertainment news. We're going to go all the way to Gen Z, from YouTube taking over the horror genre to Olivia Rodrigo redefining pop music. And then we're going to also talk about maybe you partying with Madonna a little bit.
Oh yeah, that one time at the Abbey. It was sweaty. But in a good way. New episodes drop every Wednesday on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts.